So listen, here's a thought. If the government can't get its act together policy-wise, maybe businesses can? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. The last day of July today. It's a Monday. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We begin today with an attempt to bring order out of chaos. Not the new chief of staff at the White House, not the new vacancy in the White House communications director's job, but businesses and lobbying groups putting health care behind them and trying to get people to focus on tax reform, the chosen next priority for Republicans in Congress. Tens of millions of dollars in ads and influence work is set to be unleashed to that end. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with more on what those groups are hoping to get for their money.
The on switch has been flipped at some of America's biggest conservative organizations when it comes to driving tax reform through Congress.
You're going to see a major nationwide push from us, and we will not waver until the job is done.
James Davis is vice president of Freedom Partners, a market-oriented advocacy group. He spoke this morning at a panel discussion on tax reform put on by Koch brothers-funded Americans for Prosperity. Conservative-leaning political groups have separately pledged millions to promote tax reform in the coming months. Tim Phillips heads Americans for Prosperity.
We have no illusions about how difficult this is going to be.
That's good, because it's going to be real difficult.
These spending efforts are nice, but I don't think it's going to affect the politics very much.
Stan Collender is with MSL Group.
Congress cannot, let me repeat that, cannot simply pivot to tax reform when they get back in September.
First, Congress has to figure out spending bills and the debt ceiling while trying to avoid a government shutdown. That's just for starters. Norm Ornstein is with the American Enterprise Institute.
We're moving into a series of legislative snags here, caused by the rules and by deep divisions in the majority party in both houses.
Republicans are divided on whether the tax cuts should be offset in some way. They also disagree on what spending should be cut. Again, MSL Group's Stan Collender.
Just remember, in the 80s, the last time we did comprehensive tax reform, it took 3 years. And life was a lot easier then. There was no Twitter.
And that was in a world where Republicans and Democrats spoke to each other. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There was no Twitter. That's pretty good. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said this morning, by the way, that he believes there's going to be a tax bill on the floor by November. All right, moving on. Earnings season is upon us. It is well underway, truth be told. And so far, corporate profits have been pretty good. Surprisingly good, actually. Most of the companies in the S&P 500 that have reported so far have beaten analysts' expectations. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from biggies like Apple and Archer Daniels Midland and Allstate as well. Marketplace's Amy Scott looks at what corporate health can tell us about the strength of this economy.
Ford, Facebook, HSBC, Samsung all had better than expected profits last quarter. Kevin Nicholson is chief market strategist at Riverfront Investment Group. He says of the S&P 500 companies that have reported so far,
about 77% have had positive earnings surprises. And for those companies that have surprised, they have surprised on average by about 5%.
Meaning they made on average 5% more money than analysts predicted. Nicholson says some of that is from companies talking down expectations amidst weak economic growth in the first part of the year. But analysts say energy companies have benefited from stabilizing oil prices, banks are profiting from rising interest rates, and Quincy Crosby, chief market strategist with Prudential Financial, says exporters are cashing in on the weaker dollar.
That's helped underpin the results coming from companies that, you know, have a good portion of their sales overseas.
Eventually, those higher profits should be passed on to workers in the form of higher wages. But Samir Samana, a strategist with the Wells Fargo Investment Institute, says if you look back at the economic recovery so far,
corporate profitability has grown at a much faster pace than wage growth. And so companies have taken up a larger and larger share of GDP and left less for the consumers and for the workers.
Analysts will be watching for better wage growth in the July employment report out this Friday. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Another couple of quick things here. Number one, oil. Remember that analyst report a month or maybe two ago that said crude would hit $40 before it hits 50? $49.31 at the close today. It did hit 50 at one point as rumors of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela started to circulate, which is actually item number two. Today, the U.S. government added Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to its sanctions list in a personal capacity. That, of course, after the controversial elections down there this weekend. On Wall Street today, more record highs, just like the president has been tweeting about. Oh, also because of those corporate profits Amy Scott was telling us about, too, probably, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's some internet and online access news to pass on today. Apple announced over the weekend it's pulling all major VPN services from its app store over in China. VPNs are virtual private networks. They're the go-to choice for users in China trying to get around what is called the Great Firewall over there and get to websites that would otherwise be censored by the Chinese government, Facebook, YouTube among them. That is item one. Item two is that Russia has just banned VPNs as well. Neither of those developments are good ones for companies trying to do business overseas. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Alan Evans runs a company called Fat Shark. They make hardware for drones. They have a factory in Shenzhen, China, and communicate constantly. But say he wants to share a product video on YouTube. Well, regular internet users in China can't see YouTube, so Evans set up a VPN for his company. But now he's worried that data might not be safe, so the company shares files over cellular networks.
The easiest way right now to work in China is to actually use mobile phones.
That's meant huge data costs for everyone's cell phones. He says it's worth the cost because China has a deep need to control information.
It's kind of a new form of tariff and import control that they're definitely very effectively pioneering.
Adam Siegel runs the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. He sees a trend: more states asserting more control over access to digital content.
That model's attractive to lots of countries. So Russia has been learning from China. There's a cooperative agreement on technology. I think we're going to see it continue to spread.
But Andy Rothman, investment strategist at Matthews Asia, says multinational companies today need internet-based tools to function. Restricting their access runs counter to the pro-business image China wants.
They know that if they were to effectively shut down communications for foreign firms, they'd be gone, and that's really not what they want.
What China and now Russia want to do is to stop citizens accessing illegal content. But what's illegal there might be called critical free speech here. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here with a not entirely random question: are corruption and bribery endemic to the oil and gas and mining industries? Consider this. The oil services firm Halliburton paid nearly $30 million to settle a federal case of falsifying records in a deal with Angola. The international mining giant Glencore is being investigated for paying a shady middleman on a copper mining deal in the Democratic Republic of Congo. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports that it's cases like those that have independent groups suggesting the natural resource extractive sector, that's what it's called, is the most corrupt set of businesses on the planet.
The Glencore investigation focuses on a middleman assumed to have bribed officials in the Democratic Republic of the Congo to get mining rights. Aaron Sane of the nonprofit Natural Resource Governance Institute says a common move from the corruption playbook is to find the right intermediary.
These people tend to be sort of masters of relationship building. They cozy up to the right people in government who have access to the resources.
By one measure, the natural resource sector is the most corrupt in the world. A study from an international policy group known as the OECD found that in 400 bribery cases, corruption happened most often in the resource sector. UCLA political scientist Michael Ross.
Corruption is incredibly hard to study. We don't know what we don't know. But I think this accords with the gut sense of many people who work in this area, that the extractive sector is where the big problem is.
Lots of reasons are given as to why. The amounts of money can be staggering, often in poorer countries where the rules don't always apply. And decision-making is concentrated in a few people who can be bought, says Daniel Ballant-Curdy of the investigative group Global Witness.
So presidents can easily sort of grab control over oil and mining blocks. Whereas if you take agricultural produce produced by hundreds of thousands of farmers across the country, that's intrinsically much harder to control.
Today, many governments require companies to disclose their payments overseas, but the Trump administration is undoing those rules for companies listed in the U.S. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I missed this one last week, but a federal court has apparently ordered the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, to respond to a consumer petition complaining that the ever more cramped conditions on airplanes are a genuine safety issue, that people might not be able to get out safely in an emergency. That's sort of the flip side of what's been happening in airports proper, which are getting ever bigger and more expansive, also more crowded with ever longer lines to stand in. That's bad enough for all of us, but it's especially a problem for older flyers, a group that is growing fast, but whose travel concerns are only now being heard, as Ashley Miltite reports.
May I have your attention, please?
Midge O'Fell is sitting at an outside check-in area at LAX. She's 87 and traveling alone. She says she still enjoys flying. The worst part is the hanging around.
It's hard for me to stand for any period of time. So if there's a lot of passengers and I have to wait in line, that's the hardest part.
And that fatigue is just one of the things mentioned in a 2014 study about older flyers produced for the Transportation Research Board. Others include difficulty reading signs, handling bags, and walking long distances. Jonathan Massey is a principal at Corgan, the architecture firm that wrote that report. He says airports would have to spend money to make some design changes.
Finding different technologies and different systems, ways to move those people through the building, does point you in the direction of a much higher level of investment.
Currently, airports and airlines rely on relatively low-cost assistance via wheelchairs and carts, but those solutions don't always work. Last Thanksgiving, Lauren Tucker and her 85-year-old mother were heading to Charleston and had to switch planes in Charlotte, but the cart that was meant to get them and a lot of other seniors to their connecting gates didn't turn up. The minutes ticked past. Everyone was getting anxious.
I finally started just running down the concourse looking for somebody with a cart.
They barely made it. Then the doors closed behind them. Joan Eisenstadt knows the feeling. She's 70 and lives in Washington, D.C. She's working full-time as a consultant to the hospitality industry.
And traveling more than I'd like to.
She uses a cane at home, but needs a wheelchair pretty much everywhere else, so she books ahead through the airline. But after one recent landing, she waited so long for her chair to arrive, even the crew got ready to disembark.
The next crew was right outside the plane ready to board, and in fact, they did board. And everybody kept saying, well, we'll check on the wheelchair, and it didn't come. They were ready to board the next flight's passengers, and I was still on the flight.
She complained to the airline, but they said, sorry, not our problem. That service is provided by a contractor. She's had so many bad experiences, she's complained a lot. But one complaint did bring a happy ending. She was marooned outside the terminal one cold morning at Reno Tahoe Airport in Nevada.
Unbeknownst to us, she had had a very bad experience traveling as a disabled passenger.
Brian Culpin is vice president of marketing and public affairs for the airport. After Eisenstadt gave him an earful, the airport made changes. They brought in a disabilities expert for advice, set up a new drop-off area for wheelchair users, and they're adding other amenities.
Visual paging is the next thing that we're looking at here in the airport.
So anyone hard of hearing can see those overhead announcements displayed on a nearby screen. Eisenstadt says if only more airports and airlines could make some adjustments, it would make her life a lot easier.
I get so anxious before any trip that it adds to the stress of the work I'm going to do.
And Jonathan Massey of architecture firm Corgan says stressed travelers are the last thing airports want, but not for the reasons you might think.
People who are stressed don't shop. They don't spend money. They focus on getting to their airplane.
He says improving older passengers' experience could directly affect airport revenues. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
coming up.
I was rather confused. I was like, where'd my money go?
Oh, me too, man. Tax withholding, a rude awakening indeed. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 0.2% today, 60 points, 21,891. NASDAQ down 26, 0.4%, 63.48. The S&P 500 off a point, less than 0.1%, 24.70. That was the day. For the month, it was a beaut. I got to tell you, the Dow up 2.5%, S&P 500 up 2%, NASDAQ up 3.4%. Told you earlier about the strong earnings season we're in the middle of. That's not all good. Groupon, Weight Watchers, and Snap are all going to report in the next couple of weeks. Today, Groupon dealt 1% to the downside. Weight Watchers down 3.6%. Snap down 1%. Bond prices, well, they held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note, pretty much steady as well, 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Number one at the box office this weekend was Christopher Nolan's World War II film Dunkirk. Perhaps you've seen it. Number two was The Emoji Movie, a movie about those little pictures you use when you're texting and billboards for which, at least the one I pass on my way to work, says meet poop. Yet another in a developing trend of Hollywood making ever more movies on sometimes thin pre-existing ideas, intellectual property is what that's called. Alex French had a story in the New York Times Magazine this weekend called How to Make a Movie Out of Anything, Even a Mindless Phone Game. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
When did this whole intellectual property thing start in Hollywood?
You know, it's hard to say. Hollywood has always been, you know, adapting novels or comic books for movies. They've been doing that for a long time. The trend of taking something that lacks a narrative or lacks characters has been a little bit around a little bit longer than you would think. You know, sort of the first example I could think of was the Clue movie, which came out, you know, I think around the mid-1980s. Oh, yeah. But even that movie had characters and sort of like a baseline of narrative. After that, there's not much in this category until I think it's around 2007 when Battleship pops up. In this genre, you know, for a number of reasons, I think Battleship is sort of kind of a demonstrative example of what not to do.
Which gets me to sort of this question. So how do you then account for the Battleship movie, which was terrible and barely made any money, and all the money it made was overseas, versus something like The Emoji Movie, which by all accounts is also terrible, but number two at the box office this weekend?
That's sort of the secret with these movies, right, is that if you have sort of a large enough audience, sort of a large enough built-in contingency of people who are familiar with this thing and willing to spend the money on it, then it'll succeed. Also, I think with family movies, it's a little easier, right? You know, at point of purchase, you're selling two or three tickets instead of just one.
Right. And kids' movies aren't that subject to critics' reviews, right? Because I'm going to take my kid to see, you know, Despicable Me 3 no matter what the reviews are, right?
Yeah, because yeah. I want to be left alone for 2 hours.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. Could you talk to me for a minute about the Fruit Ninja movie that you discuss in this piece? What is it that makes a piece of intellectual property, a mobile app game, what makes it suitable for even consideration as to turn into a movie?
Really one thing, and that's just a massive built-in audience.
Hmm.
You've got 2 billion people who know what Fruit Ninja is, and that's kind of enough.
Is there a limit to this, or are we, the viewing public, condemned to good movies every now and then and a whole bunch of Fruit Ninja movies?
Yeah, I think we are, as sad as it is. You know, it's not like the studios are independent entities anymore, right? They're all owned by massive multinational corporations that have shareholders, and they don't want to take risks. If you've got something where there's big brand recognition behind it and a large built-in audience, it's just easier to get to make that movie and know you're going to turn a profit than a one-off original story with, you know, actors and, right, and directors and writers, presumably, that nobody's ever heard of.
Alex French is a contributing editor at Esquire. He's got a piece in the New York Times Magazine this past weekend about the Emoji Movie and IP and intellectual property and what we're seeing on the screens. Alex, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. We were talking earlier about tax policy in the aggregate, the big picture stuff of rates and brackets and corporate taxes and loopholes and how the politics of all that is going to go. Now, as Congress maybe kind of sort of gets ready to do tax reform, a detour into the nuts and bolts of taxes in this economy and how it's all going to work. First up, from Marketplace's Adrian Hill, how your money gets to the Treasury Department's bank account, federal income tax withholding, whence it came, and why. Here's Adrian.
Discovering tax withholding is its own sort of rite of passage. There's that first job.
My first job was at the Port of Long Beach. It was a summer internship where I interned in the engineering department.
And then that first paycheck.
I was getting paid $10.10.
Leonel Tescarino is 17. He spreads out a pay stub from that internship. 60 hours of pay period. He was expecting
$606.
But withholding, federal income taxes.
$60.09 were taken.
State withholding, Medicare, Social Security. His $606 turned into
$492.96. I was rather confused. I was like, where'd my money go?
Rewind to 1943. World War II. Before federal income tax withholding as we know it today.
Will you have enough money on hand to meet your payments when they fall due?
This is from a Disney-produced film promoting the virtues of saving up for taxes.
But you don't want to forget our fighting men, do ye?
No, sir!
Then you'll have to start saving right away to meet your tax payments.
It wasn't just Donald Duck who struggled to save up. Anuj Desai is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He says during the war, tax rates went up, and a broader number of people were expected to pay them. There was a wartime saying.
The income tax was trading its morning coat for overalls. You know, this idea, really, everybody was being subject to the tax now.
For the most part, says Desai, the public discussion around withholding was focused on helping the taxpayer, on solving Donald Duck's dilemma.
And so the thought was that if we withhold a little bit every paycheck, people won't have to worry about the problem of coming up with a huge chunk of money.
But withholding is also a remarkably efficient way for the government to raise money. Policymakers knew that.
You could never have levied the taxes that were levied during World War II without withholding. It was absolutely essential for that purpose.
That's economist Milton Friedman from an interview he recorded in 2003, before his death, with the nonprofit Free to Choose Media. Friedman worked with the Treasury Department at the time withholding was introduced. Post-war, withholding stuck around, much to Friedman's chagrin.
Unfortunately, once you got it installed, it's almost impossible to get rid of it. It's just too useful for the purposes of people in power.
One of the things that withholding does is it encourages people to hold their citizenship cheaper and hold the government cheaper.
Jonah Goldberg is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and senior editor at the National Review. He says withholding anesthetizes us to the actual cost of government. Sure, we feel the pain initially with that first job, but 20-plus years into my working life, and I can't tell you how much I pay in taxes each period.
When you think that government is just this thing that happens and that we're not actually paying for it, but it's not coming out of our taxes, you become more and more accustomed to ever bigger government. And you think the government is spending other people's money, not your own money.
He and some other conservatives would love to see it gone. But realistically, getting rid of withholding isn't going to happen anytime soon. Eugene Sterley is a fellow at the Urban Institute.
Withholding and its close companion, information reporting, is absolutely necessary to get compliance with the tax laws.
In other words, if our employers didn't tell the government how much we make, and if they didn't pay our taxes for us, some of us just wouldn't pay up. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
All right, so if you had your druthers, what would you like to see changed about the U.S. tax code? You can tweet at us. The show is at Marketplace. I'm at Kai Ryssdal. I've been told I should spell that, so it's K-A-I-R-Y-S-S-D-A-L. This final note on the way out today, insult to injury department. Anthony Scaramucci is the White House communications director no longer, as you know, but at least he's alive The most recent hard copy edition of the Harvard Law School Alumni Directory went out just as Scaramucci got the White House gig. His name in the new one has a little asterisk next to it, noting that he had died since the 2011 directory was published. Again, not dead, but yes, out of a job. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 0.2% today, about 60 points. The S&P 500 down a point, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.